And good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Another absolutely splendid start to the day here across the area. We've had a mainly great week with the exception of that one day where we had some rain and snow showers in the area. But I got to tell you, we are heading for the mid-50s in Park City today, 54. It's going to be that high temperature under that sunny to mostly sunny skies. A relatively mild overnight tonight is a breezy south wind start to more or less kick up here, giving us a 30-degree overnight low, and tomorrow pushing 58 degrees in Park City under a mix of sun and clouds. And we will be breezy to windy at times in and around Park City with those south winds ahead of a potent cold front related to wind, but not in any relation related to precipitation, as any of the precipitation that falls with this front up in the Pacific Northwest just completely fizzles as it arrives here locally. So it's just a wind event that will help keep those temperatures warm. It will be again in the upper 50s on Sunday and will stay in the 50s on Monday in Park City, though temperatures will start to more or less fall into the afternoon hours as a front comes through later in the day Monday. But another round of windy weather from the south. And you know, we'll see those mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies all weekend long through Monday with those warm temperatures. And then changes occur where that second front coming in on Monday with the wind brings changes with regards to both rain and snow, but also much colder temperatures where we'll go back into the upper 30s to near 40 for the daytime high. We are anticipating a mainly snow event for Park City. How much snow is yet to more or less to be determined, but a few inches is likely over that time frame. But we'll stay cold behind it through midweek, and we'll have the opportunity to see scattered snow showers here through the midweek time frame as well, and with temperatures only in the mid to upper 30s. So a real shot of spring here until then. So enjoy it while it lasts, and enjoy being outdoors, because it's all going back to winter here next week.
Okay. Thanks, Adam.
You bet.
And with a look at the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Greg. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Yeah, we certainly are looking forward to a return to winter later this coming week. But yeah, in the meantime, we're dealing with these warm temperatures. We've gone through a wet, loose avalanche cycle this past week. So avalanche activity has really diminished over the past few days. Yesterday, we had a little bit of wet loose activity, but there was one party on a steep north-facing couloir in Little Cottonwood Canyon, something known as the Why Not Couloir, that did experience some wet activity that funneled down to tight portions of a chute they were ascending. So as you're making plans for today, be sure to give some thought to where you position yourself. And if you are exposed to a possibility of wet, loose avalanche activity, make sure that you have room for escape. So we're going with normal caution, and I'm expecting some additional wet, loose avalanche activity by late morning with warm temperatures and strong sunshine. And we're calling this a low danger. That is defined as small avalanches in isolated areas or extreme terrain. So low danger, but I do think that we will see some minor wet loose avalanche activity. One thing that we're asking you to do is as you're traveling today, particularly if people get into bigger terrain, is evaluate snow and weather conditions as you are traveling and update your own forecast based upon what you're observing. Warm today, breezy tomorrow, and you know, hopefully return to winter by about Monday or Tuesday of this coming week.
Okay, Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt in just a minute here. Later on in the hour, the Executive Director of VoterRise, Hope Zaitin Gokaritz, has details about tomorrow's Utah Women's Voter Registration Day conference. We've got some Park City women participating in that. Stay tuned. And coming up in local news this hour, at the 11th hour, the Utah legislature introducing a bill that would require state authorities to use a state fund to take out loans for future projects. This could change the public process of how the Military Installation Development Authority, known as MIDA, spends its money. We'll also have this week's Friday Film Review, and Park City's newest librarian, Daniel Thurston, will be bringing Spanish language services to the local Park City Library. So stay tuned for those stories. First, on the phone with me, I've got Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Leslie.
So any interesting new projects that have come through the door since we last spoke?
In terms of interesting, I guess everything's interesting, but in regards to any major commercial development applications or mixed-use projects or big residential projects, none really to speak of. Since we talked last, actually, and just within the last couple of weeks, we got about 24 new projects coming in. I think the nature of the projects, again, plat amendments, people moving building pads around, accessory buildings, people, you know, requests to build some water storage tank, all those sorts of things just sort of point to we're still continuing to be busy on the development side of things. One thing that I've noted when I saw the list here the other day is we're getting applications for sign permits, and people say, well, you know, that's probably not a big deal. But I think what it's beginning to indicate is perhaps maybe some of the local businesses, the local economy is starting to come out of the pandemic. New doors are opening up and new businesses are opening up. And so I see that as an encouraging sign. But like I say, no new big significant projects, just a lot of down to business, normal zoning administrative permits coming in that we'll be working through.
Okay. We've got the Snydeville Basin Planning Commission meeting Tuesday. Any big issues for them?
Well, just a lot of work to get through, and a couple of things I want to be able to highlight for folks if they want to join us for those discussions. We're going to be starting at 4:30 on Tuesday. The first up on Tuesday is going to be a discussion, a work session discussion with the commission on some general plan updates, some general plan amendments. The subject on Tuesday is going to be recreation and open space, two elements of our general plan for the basin. We're going to be inviting in our colleagues from Basin Recreation to be part of that discussion. One of the items, time permitting, that will be introducing the commission to is the work that Basin Rec has been doing with some studies and some planning on neighborhood trailhead planning. Again, this won't be a public hearing. It won't be a deep dive into that discussion, but it'll at least be an opportunity to begin that dialogue openly with the community in front of the Planning Commission. Again, really the emphasis in this discussion is taking a look at what our objectives and our visions are going to be when it comes to moving forward with open space initiatives and trail and recreation planning. And we thought it would be a really good idea to bring in one of our counterpart groups of colleagues. So that'll start at 4:30. At immediately sort of following up on that, we'll move from general plan discussions to possible code amendments. Ray Milner and Jennifer Strader will be bringing some possible code amendments. Actually, what we're going to be doing is framing a discussion that will lead to some amendments on workforce housing. Jeff Jones will be joining us. We're also inviting in Patrick Matheson from Mountainlands Community Housing Trust to join in that. Workforce housing, always a big topic, sometimes a sensitive topic here in Summit County. We want to be able to take a look at what we have in terms of our existing language. Have conditions changed? Do we need to modify some of that? Do we need to take some of that language out and replace it with some new? So I think what we want to have is an initial discussion with council and then come back and propose, you know, the possible amendments. We don't want to get too far out in front of ourselves. And again, having Jeff with us and having Mountainlands with us, I think will result in somewhat of a much more holistic discussion. So we have that. Anaya's Market is interested in moving out from Park City out into the basin, out into the Silver Creek area. We're going to be bringing that project to the Planning Commission.
That's going to involve a couple of things, a low-impact permit and a plat amendment. The project is located at 7047 North Silver or North Pace Place. This is, if you're driving into Silver Creek, would be to the north and the east of the Bell's gas station. What they're talking about is two buildings being constructed. I think the overall square footage on that is somewhere south of 30,000 square feet for the two combined. It would be a market, cafe, deli for Anaya's. There'd be a small satellite building next to that for either retail or offices. Above the market and those retail spaces, 10 workforce housing units are proposed as well. So an interesting project. Again, just work session on that item, but I think that'd be of interest to the folks out in the Silver Creek area and, frankly, the community at large. Then we move into the regular agenda starting at 6. We have the Silver Summit Academy. That's a school, a South Summit School District school out in the Silver Summit area. That's going to be remodeling some existing space to expand their school out there. We have a hearing on a remand for the Wild Away Ranch Indoor Riding Arena that went to the Planning Commission in November. That facility was denied. It went to council on appeal a few weeks back, I think February 10th. The council remanded that item back to the Planning Commission to take a further look at a couple of things. There's a couple elements of the code that I think the council wanted more specific findings on, and I think it related to the issue of the scale or the human scale of the structure, some of the architectural provisions, the use of the proposed materials, which I think have changed at this point. So that's going to be going back to the Planning Commission. Highland Flats, a big, big discussion that we had at the last meeting, will be back for deliberation, possible direction, possible recommendation. And then, if that wasn't enough for a big meeting, we have a conditional use permit for a group home in Highland Estates. It's on Highland Drive, 150 East Highland Drive. That project is bringing forward a proposal for a project called ROOTS, which is an acronym, I believe, for Retaining Our Original Truths. It's taking a 13,000 square foot existing home and outbuildings and converting it into a facility to assist young women who are struggling with depression and anxiety, trauma, those sorts of things. So group homes are CUPs in that particular zone. It's in the rural residential zone. And that's pretty much the agenda. It's a big agenda for Tuesday night.
Yep. Hey, I want to just jump back, though. I mean, when you start talking about general plan amendments, you know, this opinion piece in the New York Times caught my eye this morning. You know, we hear that collectively we do want affordable housing, workforce housing, but the reality is it's only if it's not in our backyard. And there's this piece I would encourage you to read. It's like how Berkeley beat back the NIMBYs. Basically, the Berkeley City Council adopting a measure that acknowledges the racist history of single-family zoning and begins a process to eliminate the restriction by 2022. So when we talk about general plan amendments, I don't know that we're there yet in terms of like looking at the social equity of our zoning here. Or are we?
Well, I was waiting for the end if it was a question or a statement, and I think it's both, Leslie. I agree with you. I don't know if we are. And with me saying that, I'm not stating a conclusion. I'm just simply stating that housing is more than just simply providing an opportunity to have our workforce close to where they work. It's bigger than that. It's broader than that. It's social equity. It's community diversity. all those things rolled together. The language that we have in the general plan now and the code that we use, the development code chapter 5 provisions that are meant to implement that, I think are always in need of revisiting. And I think we need to check our community values on where they are. I don't believe we're necessarily there yet. I guess I would put forward the premise. I don't know if we will ever solve the problem, but much like our transportation and traffic problems, there are ways that we can better manage that. I can't emphasize enough that the general plan language that establishes that set of priorities, that goal, that vision, that idealized version of the solution is so fundamentally important. And in our existing general plan, it puts as a high priority the need to create the housing, to put it throughout the community. I just sometimes that word integrated is so overused, you know, but really the concept is to have a variety, a mix, a diversity throughout the community, not just simply in one, you know, location. And the built environment of the county is such that oftentimes it kind of makes that difficult. You know, we are running out of land resources relatively quickly. And so, you know, the opportunities lie right now with one, either redevelopment opportunities within existing developed areas, or those pieces of property that, for whatever the reason, haven't been built on. Those properties that haven't been built on to date, there's probably a reason why they haven't. They probably come with, you know, some form of, you know, limiting factor or, you know, obstacles for you know, development. And, you know, that's where we're at. But I think, you know, beginning this discussion on Tuesday is important. You can't separate it with some of the discussions that we've been having on specific projects. You know, the Dakota Pacific project out at the Tech Park, Highland Flats, you know, where we go with some of our, you know, government-owned land, you know, the land that the county owns, you know, is there an opportunity to do that there? But I'd be very interested if that just came out. Maybe offline you could send that to me. I'd love to read the article.
Sure. And, of course, I mean, when we look at the Dakota Pacific, they've got their vested rights to build something. It's just a question of what gets built on that Highland Flats parcel. That is, I think, one of those parcels that you refer to as, I mean, it's we have seen development applications come for that parcel, and given the zoning, it's just, you know, it's almost unbuildable under what somebody can do. I mean, I remember, 30 years ago when we were talking about trying to put an automobile facility out there. And of course, that's not what people wanted in their backyard. But now we've got an application for 410 units. And again, people saying, well, it's not going to work there. So, yeah, I guess it's one of those parcels. It's just like, well, what can you put there? And I don't know that we have those discussions.
Just to get back to your point, I think we constantly have to give ourselves that gut check. You know, number one, is workforce housing, attainable housing, an important value in this community? Yes or no? I think there's a spectrum of opinion on that. But is that something that we need to help manage and address? Yes or no? Given what the answer to that is, if the answer is yes, let's take a look at what the characteristics of the areas that would best accommodate and where we can place, disperse, integrate these types of development opportunities. Then, once we define those characteristics, let's put in place some reasonable expectations, some reasonable codes that take down the barriers to achieving those units in those areas. And I think that's what we're going to try and begin to walk the commission through and then bring those findings up to the council, hopefully really soon.
All right. And regarding Highland Flats, I mean, what we have heard at the public hearings, citizens also concerned about the impact of the schools that 410 units could have. But that's not something the Planning Commission can even consider, is it?
Wow. You know, talk about a really difficult thing to explain to the community. When you think about what community building really consists of, you know, it's various types of land uses. It's where people live. It's where they work. It's where those civic areas are. Counted among that, you know, is how we educate ourselves, how we educate our kids. And you think that they would all be just so woven into part of that decision-making web. The fact is, I was going to say the uncomfortable fact is, but the reality is that here in the state of Utah, a city or a county can't condition a land use decision on the impact to a school district. They can't factor, you know, whether or not 100 or 200 or 500 children may be generated out of a particular development. They can't condition an approval based on mitigation factors for schools. That's a tough pill for all of us to swallow. But that is a limitation that's been placed on us by the state legislature. Now, me explaining it in those terms, I'm obviously not an attorney. I'm not a lawyer. There may be folks who have a dissenting point of view on what I just said. I just know that in practice, as part of that state legislation, that's the way we have administered those state laws for a very long period of time. My hope would be at some point in the future, we would be able to engage our legislature with the help of our school districts and our policymakers to rethink that. It's an important factor. It's hard to explain that to a neighborhood or to, you know, families with children in those schools, you know, what those potential implications could be. Unfortunately for the Planning Commission, that's just not one of their yardsticks they can use.
Okay, finally, just wanted to ask you about the transitioning back to live meetings. I mean, and what that means. I mean, we certainly have had great feedback from not only planning commissioners and city council members, as well as the public, that they really like this Zoom meeting format. Of course, it saves himself a trip to the Richens Building or to the county courthouse. Is that something that's going to happen, or is the Zoom meeting format going to be part of public meetings, you know, forever?
To be determined. This I can tell you. There's so few things that have come out of the pandemic that are good. One of those few things are what we've learned going to a remote format. I believe we will begin to transition back to live meetings. The time frame on that and when, I think, is a little to be determined, but it's coming on the near horizon. What I truly believe will happen is that even though we may go back to live meetings, everything we've learned from remote access to those meetings, I believe we will begin to integrate into a hybrid form of public meetings. I mean, think about, well, I'm going to use two examples here most recently. One was on Eastern Summit County, the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission. There was a proposal for a rezone for a campground. We had over 120 people on that Zoom meeting. Those 120 people would have never fit into the county services building in Camas. You know, they would have had to drive and probably gotten really frustrated that they couldn't get in the building, let alone into the meeting auditorium. Highland Flats, I think somewhere around, I'm pretty close to this, at one point I saw 220 people. Those people would have never fit into the Richens building. You know, our remote access via Zoom allowed people to plug in from their homes. I mean, they didn't have to, you know, leave their houses or skip dinner or, you know, couldn't get their kids a bath that night. They could listen, review, and comment remotely. We're working on that. Our colleagues in the IT department, Ron Boyer and his crew, have already been putting together a strategy on how we can continue that remote public comment, that participation. We'll probably transition, you know, sort of gradually back, but I think the idea of people being able to participate without physically being in the room isn't just a good idea. It's going to be a reality, and I 100% support it because, again, the best decisions are made with the most input involved. You know, there's the old saying that, you know, you're so affected by those who show up. This just gives more people a chance to show up and, you know, be able to be part of the decisions that will affect them in their neighborhoods. I 100% about being able to create those opportunities. I'm excited about it, actually.
Okay. Hey, Pat, I'm out of time. Thanks for yours, as always.
Always, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Hey, and a big thank you so much for all of you who have made pledges to KPCW during the pledge drive. We sure appreciate your great support. Taking a look at some local news now. At the 11th hour, the Utah State Legislature introduced a bill that would require state authorities to use a state fund to take out loans for future projects. As KPCW's Jessica Lowell reports, this could change the public process of how the Military Installation Development Authority, known as MIDA, spends their money.
MIDA is the state authority building the Mayflower Resort adjacent to Deer Valley in Wasatch County. It's one of three land use authorities in the state, along with Inland Port and Point of the Mountain Authority. To repay the bonds for building the infrastructure and ski lifts of the Mayflower development, MIDA is using tax increment collections. This type of financing uses the increases in property valuation within the project area as guaranteed income to pay off the bonds over the next 40 years. A bill introduced earlier this week would create a state bank to hold funds from the legislature. State authorities could then take out loans from the bank to fund future projects. Speaking during a Senate committee meeting, the bill's sponsor, Senator Jerry Stevenson, who's also a member of the MIDA board, said the loans would be paid back to the taxpayer.
They would be long-term loans, and the bank would be funded up front by the Utah State Legislature. And we have money appropriated in this last bill that would allow money to set in this loan fund until the bankers or the loan committee determines where that goes and whether it makes good sense, and that's a good direction for the for us to move on these authorities.
The bill also creates a loan approval committee, which would consist of board members appointed by the governor, Speaker of the House, Senate President, and Chair of the Permanent Community Impact Fund Board. Stevenson says the loans set up through the bill are not generally taken out through a public process.
But as far as asking for a loan, why they need the loan, that would all be determined in a public meeting. It would be determined by their board, and then they would make that request. What this is really does, this builds a fence around those funds. This doesn't turn a block of funds over to any of these authorities. They have to go through a process to get access to them.
Kristen Williams is the MIDA team communications advisor. In an email, she said in order for MIDA to take out funds from the bank for a future project, they would have to prove it would bring in revenue to pay back the loan. However, Williams said MIDA is not receiving or asking for a loan at this time. The bill, which was introduced to the legislature Monday, barreled through the Senate, passing the floor Tuesday. It now awaits discussion in the House. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Park City's newest librarian, Daniel Thurston, will be bringing Spanish language services to our local library. KPCW's Sean Higgins has a look at what he'll be offering to Park City's Spanish-speaking community.
Daniel Thurston's first official day as Park City's Spanish Services Librarian was January 4th, but he has been hard at work translating library information and programming out what he'll be offering the city's Spanish speakers in 2021. This Tuesday, Thurston debuted Cuentos y Cantos, that's stories and songs in Spanish, and introduced himself to the community and told listeners what brought him to Park City. Thurston grew up in Provo, where Spanish was actually his first language. He said thanks to his parents, Spanish was always spoken at the house as a kid.
My mom is from Argentina, so Spanish was my first language. We taught us speaking Spanish at home. We learned English as well. It's kind of weird. I don't remember a time when I didn't speak English, but I don't know. That's just how things go sometimes.
Thurston spent time working at libraries in Provo and Pleasant Grove before coming to Park City, and he's currently working towards a master's in library science from Indiana University. He said a career as a librarian wasn't always something he thought he'd be doing, but thanks to a serendipitous job he took after college, he found his true calling.
I studied chemistry in college, and I really loved it, but I found out that working in a lab wasn't really my favorite thing. The other jobs that had similar aspects. I really like things that are organized. I like things that follow patterns and make sense. I also like being able to help people, to interact with people, to have a sense of accomplishment for what I do. I ended up getting a job at the library just, I guess, in a way, just to have a job. And I was like, hey, this is really nice. Maybe I want to do this for the rest of my life.
Thurston will host Cuentos y Cantos every Tuesday at 10 a.m. via Zoom and the Park City Library's Facebook page. He said the stories and songs will all be in Spanish, but both speakers and non-speakers are welcome to tune in. In addition to hosting Cuentos y Cantos, Thurston will also be providing Spanish language services at the library and help with Spanish-speaking curbside book pickup on Thursday afternoons. To listen to this week's Cuentos y Cantos and to catch all future shows, visit the Park City Library's Facebook page or their website, parkcitylibrary.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
The North Village developments on the Heber City and Wasatch County line have captured the community's attention, with hundreds of people giving their input. At the same time, the Heber City Council tries to define future zoning for the area. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has the latest update.
The North Village Overlay Zone Ordinance has been on the Heber City Council's agenda for months because it is the first step in guiding the development along U.S. 40 and SR 32. It's been years since Wasatch County approved some density and development rights in the area. Heber City Council member Rachel Kaler and two other council persons voted to postpone the approval of the zone changes until the next meeting on March 16th. Kaler said they've come to understand and agree on the county council's density approvals granted in 2009.
And I don't think a lot of the citizens realize that the land use is in place and approved with the county. Now, we understand that there are developments that have been approved in the county, and then there's a lot that have not. And so as a city, we've been trying to sift through what is approved, but my struggle is we're down to the nitty-gritty of, now that we've sort of agreed on an ERU chart, how does that ERU chart then convert to the land use? Because what I don't want to see happen is that we're overdeveloping these areas.
Kaler, along with council members Heidi Franco and Ryan Stack, voted to continue the North Village Overlay Zone vote because the current version leaves too many issues unresolved.
I felt like we were still undecided, and I just didn't want to go to a vote until we had more time to really dive in. The current version of the North Village Overlay Zone is filled with red lines. And so what I've asked everyone, spend the next 2 weeks reviewing this final draft and come back with your final changes. But before that, email the council members and discuss it so that when we do come to the table, we have all of our issues sorted out and we can clearly express our concerns and somehow come to a solution.
About 50 people submitted public comments to the council, but they did not have time to read each remark. Heber City Mayor Colleen Potter said they'll post public comments on the March 2nd Heber City Council agenda.
If we started down the road of public commentary, we would be an hour or 2 hours into the meeting. I felt like it was more important that we take a breath, look through the document, and we can still read those public comments. What I'm finding with the public, though, is a lot of people are saying, no development. We don't want development. And I can understand and appreciate that, but what they don't understand is the land use already entitles developers to build.
Heber City Council meets virtually on March 16th. They could vote to adopt the land use code for the North Village Overlay Zone. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
The Summit County Attorney's Office has come to a plea agreement with a man who was arrested a year and a half ago for attacking a teenager at a Park City ski resort. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that the defendant has been given 2 years probation.
The sentence was handed down on March 1st to 41-year-old Marcelo Pablo Jose Portimain. The county attorney's office reported he is a resident of Argentina and was working here when he was arrested on November 27th of 2019, just before the Thanksgiving holiday. The charging documents say that the victim, a 17-year-old girl just identified as A.E., was skiing and stopped to wait for some friends. Portimain approached and started yelling at her, then grabbed her neck and squeezed it, forcing her to the ground. He continued choking her until he was pulled off by a third party. In an email, Deputy County Prosecutor Blake Hills said the defendant and the victim did not know each other. We asked what was the reason for the attack, and Hills wrote, quote, "There is no excuse for what he did, and I am not going to give him an excuse by providing any reason for what he did." Under the plea agreement, the original charge of child abuse was reduced from a second-degree felony to a Class A misdemeanor. Third District Judge Richard Morasic suspended a jail sentence of 364 days and gave Portimain probation for 24 months. It is expected the county will ask for restitution. The victim was a Summit County resident at the time. According to Prosecutor Hills, her mother said it was very important to them that they not see Portimain during his probation. The probation stipulates that he is not to return to Summit County or have any direct or indirect contact with the victim for the 2 years. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, there is good news for those who have been waiting patiently for their COVID-19 vaccination. The Summit County Health Department emailed out vaccination appointment invitations yesterday to more than 6,300 county residents who are 40 and older. Those who had pre-registered for the vaccine at summitcountyhealth.org should have received the vaccination appointment invitation. You're recommended to check your junk folder if you don't see it. In a prepared statement, Summit County Health Department Director Rich Bulla said that the efforts by the clinic staff and volunteers at the Utah Film Studios helped make the decision to open up such a large number of vaccination appointments. While appointments are open to any Utah resident per Governor Cox's mandate, the majority of the qualified individuals who did pre-registered and received appointment invitations are Summit County residents. If you know of someone who falls into that age group but has not pre-registered for the vaccine, you can go to summitcountyhealth.org/vaccine to pre-register. Those who sign up after today will likely have a 4 to 6 week wait to schedule an appointment in Summit County. That estimate is based on current vaccine allocations and would be updated as more information on vaccine shipments become available. Any Utah resident over the age of 40 will be eligible to pre-register in Summit County. For any questions concerning the COVID-19 vaccine registration or appointment making process, you can call the Summit County COVID-19 hotline at 435-333-0050. As of yesterday, that phone was busy and actually not accepting messages. Well, in celebration of the second annual Utah Women's Voter Registration Day held on February 14th and International Women's Day held on March 8th, Voterize has organized a virtual half-day conference tomorrow. On the phone with details, I have the Executive Director of Voterize, Hope Zittin-Koretz. Good morning to you, Hope.
Hi, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So first, if you would just remind us of what Voterize is. I mean, what is it that you do and how is it that you're funded?
Sure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that and for taking the time to speak with me today. So Voterize is a 501c3 nonpartisan nonprofit that was founded by Park Cityites in 2016. And our mission is to make sure that anybody who is eligible to vote gets registered to vote and then turns out to vote. So specifically, we target those historically and currently underrepresented groups who don't participate as much electorally. So that includes women, Black, Indigenous people of color, impoverished communities, and so on. And we're funded mostly by individual contributions as well as help from our board. So it really is a community effort.
Yeah, so it's just a Utah organization then?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell us what's happening tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow is a really big day for Voter Eyes and Utah Women. From 8 until 2:15, we have the Utah Women's Voter Registration Day and International Women's Day Virtual Conference. Kind of a mouthful, so we're just calling it the Virtual Women's Conference. And this is to celebrate the second annual Utah Women's Voter Registration Day and International Women's Day, like you mentioned. And this is an opportunity to really bring attention to why Voter Eyes initiated the House Concurrent Resolution in the Utah Legislature in 2019 to create a Utah Women's Voter Registration Day. Of course, it lands on February 14th. Not only is it Valentine's Day, but also a very important day in Utah history. On February 14th, 1870, the first woman to cast a vote under equal suffrage laws did so in Salt Lake City on February 14th, 1870. So to really shine a light on that, and then to kind of shine a light on where we are currently in terms of women's electoral engagement, we're not doing so well. We actually have about 300,000 women in the state of Utah who are eligible to vote, but not registered. So we wanted to create this holiday. It passed both houses of the legislature unanimously and was signed into law by Governor Herbert. And last year to celebrate, we held a kickoff press conference at the Capitol with female elected leaders, organized 15 voter registration drives around Utah, and registered 763 voters. So when we were trying to plan what to do for this year, for this celebration, you know, if 2020 taught us anything, it's how to adapt. And so we really wanted to do something that highlighted Utah women and our accomplishments and contributions, as well as talking about things that matter to us in a way that our community can come together. I know that being together in person isn't really something we've been able to do for about a year now. But seeing people on a screen is the next best thing. So still having that community with you. So that's why we decided to hold a virtual discussion series and the conference. So the conference happening tomorrow, tickets are $20 and the sales do end tonight at 11:59 p.m. But it's half a day and you get access to amazing discussions by Utah women. I mean, there are some that are Park Cityites, for example, Beth Armstrong of the People's Health Clinic, Geraldine Dreyfus, as well as some others as well, too. So we're really, really excited. There will be panel discussions about why we need women everywhere and women in different sectors. We'll be talking about why that's necessary and important. We'll have panels about the value of inclusivity, where Black, Indigenous women of color and LGBTQ plus advocates will speak about the challenges of being diverse in Utah. Another one that we have, another breakout session, is the power of youth engagement, where young activists will speak about why it's important to get involved. Another breakout session is having your voice heard on every level, and we'll have city, state, and national experts talk with us about how do we contact our representatives and why does it even matter and what do they do? And another session is building resilience and overcoming setbacks. I think that this is definitely very important for women as well too. I know that we have a lot of challenges, and some are different and some are similar. And so we'll be hearing from doctors of psychology as well as community leaders as well. And then of course we'll have some speakers about leadership and how to be a leader. But it's going to be an incredible half day of just incredible, game-changing, intelligent, talented women. And we're really, really hoping that if you are available tomorrow, buy your ticket today, attend tomorrow. I know as women, we're doing a million things at once and have a million things going on. So if you can't make the whole day, just by buying a ticket, you do get access to the full day's recordings. And so you can go back to those recordings and listen to the speakers. So that's what we're doing. We thought that, you know, Utah Women's Voter Registration Day is only one day. Utah women deserve a little bit more celebration than one day. So we decided to lengthen it for about a month. So we're really, really excited. And we hope that everybody can join us. And you can buy your $20 ticket at voterise.org/UWVRD2021. So we're really excited, Leslie. We hope that everybody who's able to can join us.
Okay. So is there a schedule also someplace online that people can look to see when these discussions are taking place?
Yes, that will be on our website, voterise.org/UWVRD2021. Those aren't just random letters, too. They stand for Utah Women's Voter Registration Day. So somebody can even just type in voterise.org, and that's voterise with an S. And it'll be up there, right there at the top, Utah Women's Voter Registration Day 2021. Click on it, and the full day's conference schedule will be there, as well as the bios of our speakers.
All right. So we heard so much about voting irregularities after the November election. Should we believe it?
No. There are many, many nonpartisan entities and officials that really, truly looked into claims and did not find anything of value. For example, in Utah, we've been doing vote by mail for years now. We love it. It's reliable, safe, secure. And Utahns have got it down to a pat. We love a vote by mail. And why wouldn't you? You get a vote in your pajamas from home. So it's safe, it's secure, it's reliable. Anybody who says otherwise, that is a false claim. And that has been looked into by many nonpartisan entities and officials. So we're very confident that the past election was accurate up and down the ballot. Yeah. Thank you for asking.
And you mentioned the 300,000 Utah women who are eligible to vote and haven't voted. So how are you going to reach out to them?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So last year and the end part of 2019, we actually had a challenge called the 2020 Challenge. And when somebody signed up to become an ambassador for the 2020 Challenge, they were given training and physical and digital materials to register at least 20 other women in their life. So at the end of the election cycle in October last year, we reached 772 ambassadors, each dedicated to registering 20 Utah women. So very incredible. Our original goal was 1,000. Of course, the pandemic hit. So we are very confident that if it hadn't, then we would have surpassed that goal. But 772 ambassadors, each dedicated to registering 20 women. And of course, that's one of the reasons why we're holding this conference, to spread awareness and to encourage the women in our lives to be electorally engaged. Whether, you know, that's just making sure that you check your voter registration routinely, to, you know, making sure that you are there during community council meetings, or, you know, being part of your PTA or running for office, you know, just being electorally engaged in our communities is very, very important. And so that's one of the reasons why we're holding this conference as well.
Yeah. And is the focus for a Voterize just on women? I mean, my guess is that we've got a significant number of men that also eligible but not registered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great point. Yeah. So there are a little bit more women who are unregistered but eligible. Truth be told, though, there are almost as many men. So you do have almost about 500,000 individuals in Utah as of 2018 census data that are eligible but unregistered to vote. So we don't just focus on getting women registered to vote. Our target is also those who electorally have not been turning out to vote. So, for example, 18 to 29-year-olds, youth voters tend to not turn out as much, which is fairly problematic in a very, very young state like Utah. And those who are part of a diverse group and an underrepresented community. So Black, Indigenous people of color, which includes, in Utah specifically, we have large amounts of Latinx individuals who are not registered to vote but eligible, Pacific Islanders as well. So those are two of our biggest groups in Utah that we target. But just anybody who is eligible to get registered, we do a lot of social media campaigns. And then we actually send out a Get Out the Vote guide where about 3 weeks before every election, when ballots are mailed out, we actually send out a nonpartisan get out the vote guide where it has all the candidates that somebody might be voting on side by side with each other. So you can, you know, really see their faces side by side and where they stand on an issue. Like, for example, you can drop down to healthcare and see what they've said about that, links to all of their social media and website. And then after you pick your choices, your candidates, then they actually go onto something that kind of looks like a scorecard. It's almost like a grocery shopping list. And you can actually print it out or mail it to you, or email it to you. And so when you, if you decide to actually vote in person, then you can actually take that with you, and you've already made very informative decisions. You've done your research. And it also shows you where you can vote and what time your polling locations are open, as well as early voting. So it's really a two-pronged approach where first we get you registered to vote, but it doesn't really do much unless you turn out to vote. So that's where that get out the vote guide comes in. So we're very, very excited about that. And we're really hoping that we see similar turnout numbers this year as we did last year. Of course, election year is an annual thing. And this is what's called an off year, even though it's not. There's still elections going on, specifically municipal elections in Utah. And it's really important to be engaged during these city elections because, you know, these are individuals who make decisions very, very personal to you, very literally close to home. These are the individuals that get to decide property lines and where your kids get to go to school, or whether or not to put a crosswalk in across from your house because you saw a kid almost get hit there the other day. Or, you know, there's so many things that these local officials do. And we really are trying to get more word out on what they do and how to contact them and to be engaged on not just the federal level, but also state and then city as well, too. Okay. So it's something that we have been hitting hard and will continue to hit hard while we go into primary season as well as the general election.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Hope, thanks for your time. Again, if people would like more information, it's voterize.org. This is KPCW Park City.